so much changes from when you start drug discovery to when you launch a product. I mean, it could be a decade later. And that's why, in many ways, the pharma business is a business of shots on goal. You have to build a portfolio of strong potential opportunities, because many of them, you know, many of them are not going to work from a clinical perspective. And then many of them may not work from an economic perspective.
This is Tectonics, the podcast focused on the people and passion at the intersection of technology and health.
The gap between the promise and practice of technology has been especially vivid in the area of pharmaceutical clinical trials, where even switching from paper to electronic data capture has proved too radical for some sponsors. Our guest, Kara Dennis, Managing Director of Digital Health at Medidata, seeks to change all this and help the industry modernize.
This is Tectonics. I'm Lisa Soonan.
And I'm David Shaywitz. This episode is sponsored by DNA Nexus, the secure and compliant cloud platform that enables enterprise users to analyze, collaborate around, and integrate massive amounts of genetic and other health data. So, Lisa, one of the topics I think I get asked about, maybe even more than any other, involves the application of digital health to clinical studies. There's just this profound gap between the apparent promise of the technology and where much of the field seems to be in practice, as in fact one of our guests, UCSF neurologist John Hickson, talked about lately.
Yeah, I think it's true. And it seems to me there's still even just a vast cultural divide between what some of the scientists and pharmaceutical companies think about the use of technology. It's very new school, right? And the old school guys maybe look askance at it in some ways, even though it might solve some pretty remarkably big problems.
Right. And so it's not how we've done it, you know, and there's such a role for precedent.
Not our class, dear.
Right, exactly. So given this, you can see how excited we are to welcome a leading voice from the frontier of digital health and clinical trials, Kara Dennis of Medidata. Welcome, Kara.
Thank you for having me. It's such a pleasure.
All righty. Well, hopefully you'll feel that way at the end. So as excited as we are to learn what you're working on in digital health, we'd also really like to understand your journey. And in particular, how did you go from an idealistic Yale graduate and field hockey star working at Teach for America to McKinsey, Harvard Business School, and a job in the clinical trials industry? Walk us through your descent from grace, maybe starting with your bright college years. What did you study at Yale, and do you prefer Sally's or Pepe's?
So I'll start with the Sally's or Pepe's, and I think I ate at each of those institutions, venerable institutions, once each. So I'm going to go with bar pizza, and the reason for that is the mashed potatoes on top of the pizza cannot be beat by any of those older institutions.
Wow, it's like a carbgasm.
It is.
You're originally from Chicago, right?
I am. I did grow up in Chicago. So I grew up with the deep dish pizza. No potatoes on that.
But it would hold a lot more potatoes.
It would hold more potatoes. Now, see, that's the problem is once people are from Chicago, like they just sort of their whole view of, well, probably many things, but particularly pizza is warped because they can never really appreciate New Haven style pizza. That's the dilemma.
Yeah, well.
I actually think coming from Chicago, everything looks up, the weather, the food, everything.
That's right. But I
appreciate the question on the background, and thanks for blowing any attempt to make it sound cohesive. But coming out of Yale, I was really excited about the opportunity of Teach for America. I just thought it was the most exciting and interesting thing I could do of all the opportunities that seemed to exist.
Why was that so interesting to you?
I think it just seemed like such a challenge to have a role that was almost like a leadership and almost CEO type role, CEO of your classroom role right out of the gate, coming out of college, seemed more exciting than any of the analyst type roles that were otherwise offered. And
what did you study at Yale?
History.
Wow.
In many ways, it was an exhilarating experience. It's also the hardest thing I've ever done. It was the most difficult 2 years of my life. And actually, my work experience since then has all seemed so easy by comparison. But it's a fascinating and complicated program, Teach for America. I'm happy to talk about it in more depth. I won't go into that here. But I think it is, the challenge is supported in a lot of ways by just how much learning and growth happens during those 2 years. So I do feel like I've taken a lot away and continue to think about it almost every day. But coming out of those 2 years, I felt like I wanted to do something where, and actually one of the things that drove this is the school I worked for West Harlem in New York City. I was just really disappointed in the leadership decisions, in the leadership of my school, the culture, and it felt like I wanted to be in a place where I could learn what good leadership looks like and what good decisions look like and how good companies are run. I felt like I didn't see that in my 2 years at the school and, within the Department of Education. So that was my big reason for leaving. So that's why.
And of all the industries you picked, healthcare to find.
So I've learned life is not perfect outside that, but there are so many advantages of working in a company where, people are incentivized and motivated to collaborate, to find common ground and solutions, to come up with better answers, to innovate. That's just not always in place in education.
So how did you find your way into health?
Yeah, so I joined McKinsey after Teach for America and started working for life sciences clients. So I was at McKinsey for 2 years before and after business school. And the more work, I did some work for financial institutions, but then increasingly worked in healthcare. So I worked for pharma companies, for private equity that was looking at pharma companies or looking at other life sciences. I worked for healthcare providers and then also healthcare payers. So I got a good sense of the landscape. And just the more I worked in healthcare, the more interested I was in the development of new therapies, how therapies are identified, how they're brought to market, how they can address unmet needs. That just was the most interesting segment of, the universe of clients that McKinsey served. So I just started getting really excited about that, and I haven't left.
So when you think about, you had an interesting opportunity. You worked across all different parts of the healthcare system, payers, mm-hmm. providers, pharma, et cetera. Did you choose life science because you felt they had the most, they were the most together? They had the most creativity, the most interesting leadership, the greatest opportunity? Or why exactly?
Yeah, it felt to me like it was the closest to the development of new therapies, and a space where, I could contribute to identifying new solutions for unmet needs. So getting closer and closer to the science piece of things was what was really interesting to me.
Did you feel that it was in some ways an advantage that not coming from sort of a biology or a medicine background, where you're able to sort of see the organizational challenges sort of more clearly and in a sense not get distracted by sort of some of the other issues?
Potentially. That's an interesting way to think about it. And I hadn't considered that before, but yeah, I probably was always... I always had a probably slightly different vantage point than a lot of the people I worked with who had grown up, as you said, in biology or had MDs.
Right. We had last year on our show, we had, Bob Kocher, and he was sort of describing his experiences of, it sounds like he walked to the head of the hospitals out here around Boston and was like, okay, well, I want to run a hospital. Why don't, and then the guy who ran the hospital said, people who run them have no idea. People who are doctors, for instance, actually have no idea of any of the economics of a hospital, don't really understand what makes it run. And I wonder if there's some sort of parallel where even in pharma, so many of the people who contribute the science that pharma companies ultimately wind up leveraging have an insufficient idea about what it takes to go from discovery to therapy.
Yeah, I think it's a rare skill set to really understand the science in depth and also be able to see it as a business and to run it effectively as a business. I completely agree.
How do the big pharma companies get, or spread that economic sensibility around? I mean, everybody knows the statistics on how much it costs, $1 billion plus to get a new drug to market, yada, yada, yada. But, you know, and I think most of the pharmaceutical companies are desperately trying to figure out ways of speeding up discovery at a lot much less, you know, lower cost. But when you get down to the bench, does that sensibility continue to exist?
I don't know that it always does. And I think it differs from company to company. And I do see a lot of pharma trying to move those kinds of market analyses further back in the development pipeline. And to some extent, you know, that happens with a lot of discipline at some companies. But there still is quite a bit that's just based on, you know, intuition or knowledge of the disease. You know, this we know this disease and we know there's nothing good for it. So let's identify a therapy, you know, without thinking about how much we're able to sell it for or how many other therapies are on the market for that same condition.
But part of that challenge, though, right, is has to do with the fact how hard prediction is. I mean, in fact, there's some excellent analysis that, of course, was done a few, maybe a decade ago, I remember, from BCG, and then in a slightly different way, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, in a very rigorous way as well, by the group from McKinsey, which essentially shows that people's ability to predict sales of a drug, it bears almost no surprisingly little resemblance to what the ultimate revenues are, and the errors are just splayed. I mean, it was not so much like a hopeless piece that they put out, but it was just a very humbling piece.
Yeah, no, I think that's spot on, and a lot of it has to do with the length of the development cycles. So much changes in the world from when you start drug discovery to when you launch a product. I mean, it could be
right.
A decade later. So that's why, in many ways, the pharma business is a business of shots on goal. You have to build a portfolio of strong potential opportunities, because many of them, you know, many of them are not going to work from a clinical perspective, and then many of them may not work from an economic perspective.
Okay. So you have what it sounds like as a result of really incredible experiences, you know, like you're saying, from business school, which I've heard is, 6 months of education crammed into 2 years.
Not kindergarten with beer, I guess, is the other.
That's the other one, right. But from your experience with this, sounds like top tier clients from McKinsey, you really had an incredible sense of what are the challenges in the industry. And then you're now in this role, which I was hoping you could explain to the listeners, where you're having a chance to really lead what many regard as one of the most hopeful areas, or at least really promising. How can you use some of these emerging technologies, you know, the sort of the Silicon Valley meets pharma, Silicon Valley meets drug discovery, that Lise was just at a conference that was sort of
the Milken Global Conference.
Milken Global Conference that focused on this whole challenge. So tell us about your current role and how you're starting to think about, now that you understand that, you know, in the context of knowing exactly what these challenges are, how do you see digital health being part of the solution and not just either innovation initiative of the week on the one hand, right? Or something that it's like, yeah, like very lovely, but like it's, the risks are exceed the benefits. So it just sort of becomes a peripheral thing.
Yeah, great questions. So very, very briefly, then, the role that I'm in right now, so I work for a company called Medidata, and we make software for clinical trials. So our entire company is focused on the clinical development process, and we try to create tools to make it more efficient. And then the group I lead is focused entirely on mobile clinical trials. So that means the trials that have a wearable device or a connected biosensor or a mobile app like research.
Are there a lot of these studies? I mean, help us understand, to what extent are these sort of central, or these peripheral? How common are the type of studies that you're describing? And are they exploratory or registrational?
Still exploratory and still new and peripheral. I would say most of the large and mega biopharma companies are starting or in the midst of some initiative to at least test this, pilot some of these trials, very much still in proof of concept stage. So I do see some phase two and phase three trials with these devices, but the devices tend to be used as part of a sub-study to evaluate whether two things. One, whether or not the device or the app can tell the sponsor something about response to therapy or disease progression of the patients. And so the sub-study is a way of managing risk. So, you know, if something goes wrong with this new device, with this new technology, it won't compromise the entire study. But the sponsor, the pharmaceutical company, is still able to get some interesting insight that they may be able to pull into new trials. And that insight is likely to be both clinical and then operational. And I know we'll talk about this more in depth, but a lot of times the hang-ups related to new technology are more operational.
That's so interesting, because if you think about other industries where monitoring is done entirely automatically, you know, virtually, without the human touch, you know, and we're looking at in a world in pharma where that's still considered suspicious.
Yeah.
why is that? You know, is it because the data that comes off the wearables and the like is not reliable?
Yeah.
Or is it just old-fashioned values?
So the best way I can describe it is our clients are very used to decades of running clinical trials in highly controlled environments, or at least environments that they perceive to be highly controlled, meaning that instruments are calibrated, clinical support staff and primary investigators are trained, the blood labs are calibrated, everything is controlled, and because these trials are the scientific method where you need to control the variables, that controlled setting is paramount in the minds of many sponsors to achieving the level of data quality that they need to have. And they perceive putting, let's say, a wearable device on a patient and sending them out into the wild, meaning like home and to work and all of those kinds of things, they perceive that as potentially not having the same level of data quality. And so that creates an entirely new set of activities around evaluation of the data quality and the data validity that needs to happen. And often sponsors don't know how to do that. They don't know.
It's so ironic though, because I mean, if the drug that lowers blood pressure, for instance, doesn't lower blood pressure in the real world milieu of that patient, so what good is it if it lowers it in a lab? That's not that exciting, right?
Exactly. So I do think that there are some of the forward thinking people at pharma companies are, and I will say it, pressures from payers certainly support this. But
that's what I was wondering was, that I assume that was a key driver, was sort of the trying to come up with the value proposition for payers.
Exactly. And that is a big driver that I see and that I hear about quite frequently, is payers are looking for better and more tangible justifications of why a payer should reimburse a drug. And if you can provide meaningful input on quality of life that results from using this drug, or better comparative effectiveness data, or just better insight into what happens in the real world when patients are going about their lives in uncontrolled settings, that's very attractive to payers. And so that is certainly one of the things driving this. But I think for a long time, pharma sponsors have been in a situation where, yeah, they've got their hypothesis at the start of the trial, they test it, and they've got a group of biostatisticians that do their analysis about whether whether the drug seems to be working against a set of prescribed endpoints. Now they're in this brave new world of, to use some buzzwords, big data and data science, because they need to, because they need to figure out, questions like, is this data comprehensive? Is it accurate? Am I confident that the subjects wore their devices all the time? Did they take it off? Were they taking it off when they were sleeping? Did they give it to someone else? Those kinds of things they really worry about.
And to that end, I mean, one of the points that Lisa was making, you know, I think that no one's doing that here, of course, but it would be simplistic to sort of have the view, oh, dumb pharma, they're just so conservative, because that's part of what's going on, is my sense. But the other part of it is, you know, with emerging technologies, just like you were saying, that a lot of times the fact that they have such popular you know, they've captured it, at least briefly, I don't know, maybe they're on their way down, the popular imagination, it doesn't mean that they're actually necessarily that rigorous and that there's a lot of things that seem sexy about them. Oh, here's a, or did, you know, here's a Fitbit or here's this other thing that, that in reality isn't. I mean, you know, I think some of my favorite writing on this and experiences have been from one of our guests last season, Brennan Spiegel, who sort of described his sort of real world experiences. He goes, and he basically said, you know, until I don't even want to talk to anyone about digital health until they've actually had the experience of trying to stick one of these sensors on a patient and seeing what happens. Because there's this sort of theoretical view that some folks sitting on Sand Hill Road might have about, oh, this will disrupt everything and change the world. And there's, on the one hand, there's a very real potential of that to happen. But, you know, and I think we're obviously, you know, moving towards that point. But you're still, you know, there's still so many sort of basic aspects to be worked out. And it seems like you're at the frontier of where that's really going on. Are there some early examples of success, or what have you seen in the area of sort of digital health studies that you can share, and that's really excited you or motivated
you? Yeah. And, you know, I'll be speaking in some generalities, but I have been really excited about, some of the insights coming out in terms of ability to correlate movement or activity with some of the results or inputs from patient-reported outcomes, and so the potential to better define endpoints, because really the goal of a lot of, I should say, there's our sponsors tend to be focused on two things. One is better science. And so potentially more sensitive, continuous information towards endpoints. And the second is improved patient engagement, so better potential to recruit patients to participate in trials and better potential to keep them engaged and taking their medication properly. And on both fronts, on the part about better science, we have seen some early insights about the potential of sensors to tell us something meaningful about response to therapy or about progression of disease. So that's one thing. And then certainly on the patient engagement side of things, I think even with some of the published results from early trials of the Research Kit app, of Apple's Research Kit app, I think there have been really some interesting possibilities articulated about the potential to recruit subjects, for example, giving greatly expanding the potential pool of subjects that pharmas can address.
Oh, absolutely! I was so excited about that, and we John Wilbanks talked about that a little bit on our show again last year. He, you know, was responsible for a lot of the consent. The sort of the e-consent and the fact that it's done in such a progressive and informative fashion.
You know, I'm curious, you know, you talk about patient reported outcomes. I wonder about patient defined outcomes, as that's becoming part of the thinking of some of these clinical trials, because there's clearly a big disconnect between how patients define success of therapeutic experience and how industry does at times. You know, in terms of functional living, you know, capability and the like, versus some, you know, biological metric.
And wasn't that a big goal of the FDA's PRO, you know, patient reported outcome movement, where they actually started this listening series?
Supposedly,
right?
You know, I guess they had
fibromyalgia.
I
mean, they had a bunch of people where they're actually recognized this was a gap.
Yep.
But as someone who's on the inside of all of that, Kara, is that what you're seeing? I mean, is there a real so relevant. What Lisa's getting at is the idea of, you know, as we move towards a focus on patients, and that's something that is a real benefit of all these devices. At what level is there a drive to really understand what patients really want versus what have been the traditional endpoints that exist in the system?
I think the drive is there and it's real. And, you know, speaking of buzzwords, every pharma discussion I've had in the last 2 years, someone talks about patient centricity. So it's viable. It has to be balanced, or I see it being balanced against the need to, or the interest in being safe and in using traditional endpoints that have always been used, because there's this feeling that if we use endpoints that drugs have been approved for in the past, then this entire clinical development program that we're spending tens or hundreds of millions of dollars on is less risky.
I mean, John Hixon was going crazy about this last year, from what I recall, where he was, I mean, I may be putting words in his mouth, you know, but the general gist of what at least I recall him saying was that for his area, epilepsy, people were just essentially using these incredibly antiquated endpoints because, you know, 30 years ago, somebody at some point used that. And so even though there are so much better, their endpoints available through technology, through very basic technology that are so obviously better, everyone at the end of the day is just too chicken to pull the trigger on something like that. And they're like, oh, but they, you know, we're trying to make a little bit better version. We have to compare it to the other version. And so progress is just, what can be done, assuming it makes sense to accelerate progress and to have more relevant endpoints? Is it a regulatory challenge? Is it a cultural challenge? What could be done to utilize the technology that's available to, now that it's available, to really be sure that it drives better drug development for patients?
So I certainly think there's a regulatory piece of this, and I'll talk about that because at least on the part of many stakeholders within the FDA, there's tremendous openness to talking about these types of possibilities with pharma companies and to exploring them and to figuring out what would need to be done in order to evaluate the quality of the data and so on. But I would say I also think this is where the commercial marketplace and you know, companies focused on innovation play a role. I mean, when I wake up every day, the thing that we're thinking about is how can we use technology to take down some of these barriers and these fears and the like inertia. Because you know, as I sit at our client companies day in and day out, and they say, "Well, I don't think we can do this because it's you know, sites won't be able to train people in how to use a Fitbit or you know, or name your activity tracker. Our sites are not Apple Genius bars; they're not going to be able to troubleshoot a mobile phone for patients." And look, there's some valid concerns under that. What we just try to do day in and day out is just take away the concern, is to say, you know what, this can be done. It turns out your sites are very capable people, and every time you introduce a new ECG machine, they're able to learn that new technology. We think they can learn this technology too. We're going to have materials for them, documentation, call center, everything ready, and they're going to be able to do it. So it's like working through challenges like that, and certainly for my company, addressing those challenges through technology. So we try to take away concerns related to ingestion and management of the data, patient privacy, all of those kinds of things. And we work to help. And one of the things we focus on is try to tell customers, our life sciences sponsors, you know, we can tell when subjects are taking their devices off. We can tell when, you know, they're not wearing them properly. We can tell when it seems like you're getting bad data in the door. Something's going on with that device.
We can tell you when you're sleeping, and we can tell when you're awake. Are you guys working in the medical device world too? Because as I look at my, you know, clients, colleagues in the medical device world, so many of the devices are now moving towards embedded sensors, you know, sensors in the artificial knee that will tell you when there's too much pressure or it's about to fail, sensors in the, you know, implantable heart products that will, you know, monitor fibrillation, you know, atrial fibrillation or what have you, pressure in the heart. You know, people are going to become, you know, walking robots effectively loaded up with electronics over the course of time, particularly as they age.
Yeah.
Is that an opportunity to gather data for trials, or is that a scary thing, you know, that makes it harder and harder to get those devices approved?
I do think it's an opportunity. And I will say on the device side of things, probably our single most common use case that we get asked about from clients is this, what I'll call post-operative follow-up or post-acute follow-up. So something has happened to the patient. They've had a surgery or they've had a heart attack or there's been like a major intervention.
Yeah, they're trying to avoid the 30-day rehospitalization penalties.
Exactly. Yep. After their hip replacement, when are they able to start moving again at the level they were moving prior to hip replacement? Or, you know, post myocardial infarction, how long does it take for them to regain, you know, some some basic threshold of movement. So those kinds of that area, and I think that's very connected to med device, is a big area of interest and of need. And I think in those instances, because we are trying to hone in on these use cases where the value of this data is so intense that there is willingness to invest, to experiment, to gather the data and see what sense they can make of it, because they just realize it's going to bring so much value to them. So I think that's those areas, you know, post-operative follow-up. I'll mention one other that we see and hear about all the time, which is better assessment of neurological disease. Many neurological diseases endpoints tend to be very subjective, whether they are patient-reported endpoints or even whether they're investigator assessments. So we hear all the time about frustrations from companies that have drugs in depression, because one physician may rate severity of depression for a subject very different than another investigator, or severity of stroke. So those areas where there's real frustration with existing endpoints and need for something much better, that's where we see the most urgency and intensity in bringing these new technologies in.
Interesting.
Wow. So I know we have to wrap up. I guess one last super quick question for you is, do you think the digital health breakthrough in this area is more likely to come from a trial that's done by a large company, sort of a large established company trying to, essentially with the resources, to throw some money at something clever, or from a sort of a more of an upstart company that is going to try to do something clever as a way to create value from something unexpected?
Ah, that is a great question. I do occasionally see, this is going to be so fascinating to watch, because I do, you know, we do see some interest from, you know, very small biotechs who have one compound or molecule or therapy in the pipeline. But we also see some of these major pharma companies putting heavy, heavy investment into examination of the sensor ecosystem and identification of the best therapeutic area to put it into. So it's interesting, because they just come at it with different advantages. On the very small biotech side, there's probably less fear, more appetite for risk, more willingness to try something new. And on the big pharma side, there's more resources, more dollars, more investment, more bodies to conduct the operations of these trials.
Right.
I think my answer to that, I won't cop out. I think ultimately, a company that comes is the first one to do a phase 3 and bring it to the FDA or the EMA, I think it's going to be a bigger company.
Yeah.
In part just because those companies have the resources to run these big trials. And I think they'll have done...
They can afford the right regulatory lawyers.
Exactly. Well, Kara, we're going to...
Exactly. The big regulatory teams, big teams of data scientists and so on. So I would put my money on a larger company.
Well, Kara, this has been an absolute pleasure. We're really inspired by your work. I'm a huge admirer of the company of Medidata as well. I feel like they've been pioneers in so many areas. And I think that your work, in particular in the digital health area, is especially exciting. And we're all rooting for success and following with interest. So thank you so much for joining
Thanks
us.
Thanks for coming on today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. As I said, it's such an honor. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Kara Dennis is Managing Director of Mobile Health at Medidata. She spoke with us from New York.
That was really interesting. I think, you know, there's such a reluctance to integrate some of these new technologies into the pharmaceutical world, and yet there's so much interest in doing it. I mean, these guys, you know, from Big Pharma, I talk to them all the time.
I know.
About technology and how they can use it differently, and yet the gap between desire and implementation is profound.
It really is incredible, because you can appreciate the value of, on every level, of getting closer to the patient. It really is an interest in patient centricity, and they always seem to sort of get right up to the edge. But then there's the real practical issues. And I just think people have such a, incomplete appreciation for how conservative drug development both is, and in some sense is almost sort of compelled to be in some ways, because you just, you know, all the, you know, there's just so much invested in some of
so
these
much
studies.
Risk.
But on the other hand, someone will do something creative, someone will do something, and then all of a sudden it'll be the sort of aha moment.
Yeah.
That's another buzzword, aha moment. And then people will be like, oh, you know, it's possible.
Yeah,
so I'm really looking forward to seeing that happen.
It is fascinating to watch it go. So if you're looking for more of us, you can follow David Shaywitz's writing at Forbes.
And you can follow Lisa Soonan at VentureValkyrie.com, as well as on the Timmerman Report.
And always, you can find all of the episodes of Tectonics on iTunes and on the Connected Social Media website. So as we fade out to our cocktail music, we're grateful to our sponsor, DNA Nexus, the secure and compliant cloud platform that enables enterprise users to analyze, collaborate around, and integrate massive amounts of genetic and other data.
No doubt. Tectonics is produced by Connected Social Media and recorded in Tectonics Studio A in Hillsborough, California. Arrivederci.